Welcome to the Rights Track Podcast, where we aim to get the hard facts about the human rights challenges facing us today. In Series 1, we talk to academics who have dedicated their research to the systematic analysis of human rights problems. In Series 2, we talk to human rights advocates and practitioners involved in the struggle for human rights to learn more about their work and the ways in which academic and other research helps them. I'm Todd Landman. In today's episode, we're asking, how do human rights organizations pursue justice, and what role is there for academic research in prosecuting human rights perpetrators? My guest is Dixon Osborne, Executive Director of the Center for Justice and Accountability in San Francisco. He was co-founder and Executive Director of Service Members Legal Defense Network, a national security and human rights organization that spearheaded the effort to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell and end sexual orientation discrimination in the armed forces of the United States. Dixon served as the Director of Law and Security Program for Human Rights First, where he led efforts to align U.S. counterterrorism policies with the rule of law, achieving significant changes in policy and practice regarding Guantanamo Bay Detention Facility, torture, and the use of armed drones. So welcome, Dixon.
Thank you, Todd.
Today we're talking about how we pursue justice, and your Center for Justice and Accountability, could you just explain a little bit about what it does and how it's set up, and then we'll go into some of the more specific issues.
Our mission is, ultimately, we want to see countries to be able to prosecute human rights crimes that occur within their borders, and to have human rights abusers held to account in a court of law. And we recognize that not every country is in a position to be able to hold accountable people within their own borders. And so we look at levers across the globe to try to figure out how to advance rule of law and accountability for the very worst human rights crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, war crimes, torture, and such.
So I know you can't discuss maybe some of the specificities of some of the cases that you're working on now, but can you give us a sense of the idea of the countries you're working in and some of the cases where they're located presently?
One of the cores of our work has been to go after war criminals who've attempted to find safe haven here in the United States and to bring civil actions against them. Now, our law in the United States allows organizations and individuals to file civil complaints outside of government action. One example, in June, we went to trial against a former Pinochet officer who had been living in Florida for 3 decades. And we were victorious at trial, with the jury finding him liable for the torture and murder of Victor Jara, who was an iconic folk singer in Chile and one of the first people targeted by Pinochet during the coup. So that's one example here in the United States.
And you use civil action to do that. What's the legal category that you're operating in there?
So against Lieutenant Pedro Pablo Barrientos, we filed a claim under a statute called the Torture Victim Protection Act. And in the United States, we're allowed to file a civil lawsuit against perpetrators of torture and extrajudicial killing here in the United States. And that is what the jury found him liable under.
So you don't find them guilty for criminal liability, but you find them guilty as violating that particular act. And then what's the punishment or the redress for having been found liable under that statute?
So the jury found that he's liable for $28 million in damages owed to the family, the widow and the daughters of Victor Jara. Now, Pedro Pablo Barrientos was a line cook. He doesn't have no dollars attached to his name. The import of it is really the record of truth. And this case was a vehicle actually to shed additional light on what happened in the first days under the Pinochet coup and what happened as they rounded up masses of people in Chile Stadium, which is actually now named after Victor Jara. And so it was about truth, reconciliation, dignity, and trying to bring justice in some measure after 44 years of fighting for accountability.
So a couple of things going on there. This is a kind of lower level person from within the regime. So that intrigues me because a lot of the focus has been on holding past heads of state accountable for human rights abuse. That's one layer of the puzzle you've set out for us there. The other thing that's really interesting is that he has no financial means to actually meet the sort of financial punishment, but there's a symbolic victory at least in signaling that something wrong had taken place and somebody was being held accountable for that. And that pushes me to a third layer where I know that there are those in the human rights community that don't like truth for amnesty deals like were done in South Africa. They don't like trading off that sort of, well, we can get better stories and better narratives and more participation in a truth commission by not prosecuting people. And yet in your answer about this particular case, you talked about layers of victory, that there was the sort of legal judgment, but there was also symbolic victory, reconciliation, and a kind of recognition, if you will, that something had gone wrong. Is your organization ultimately pursuing legal accountability, retributive justice, you want to see people go to prison, or are you more nuanced in your approach?
I think it's more nuanced. Justice and accountability can take many forms, and it's really up to the individuals who've been harmed and the communities that they're a part of to identify what that means. And in this case, Joan Jara, the widow, had tried to pursue justice in the courts in Chile time and time again and kept being thwarted. It just wasn't advancing. And when we were able to identify, thanks to Chilean television, that this individual was here in the United States, we then had another avenue to try to put together sort of the history of what happened here. And indeed, we were able to get evidence that even Joan had not known about in the 44-year pursuit of justice that she has. Another thing to note is that this also isn't the end of the story, because the United States, because of our work at the Center for Justice and Accountability, the Department of Justice in the United States paid attention to what was going on. This individual, Pedro Pablo Barrientos, was a naturalized U.S. citizen. He married an American. And they're now looking at whether or not to bring charges for naturalization fraud, because he did not admit in the proceedings that he had been part of the Pinochet regime and liable for the actions that he's been found liable for. If he's denaturalized, that then opens a path for him to be extradited. And the government of Chile has asked that he be extradited, and they are looking, had an indictment against him and other actors in Chile. And an indictment is a criminal indictment in Chile for the torture and murder of Victor Jara. So there is a path, you know, for this individual to be returned to Chile and to face justice in country.
So it seems to me that you have quite a lot of legal creativity taking place here. So in your opening remarks, you talked about different levels of jurisprudence. So there's the sort of the local, the national, the international, etc. And your organization is really looking for what are the available legal levers that we have to try to prosecute these past wrongs. And yet there's a tremendous amount of creativity in discovering what might work. I know a colleague of mine did some work on the Ciudad Juarez murders in Mexico. 300 or more than 300 women were murdered in that part of Mexico. And it was a great mystery as to who was actually carrying out these murders. But at the same time, they found that the U.S. Alien Tort Act was something that could give them the legal leverage they needed to begin to prosecute. So does your organization spend a lot of time working out what's the best legal lever to pull and which cases to pursue in your overall aims and objectives?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So in the case of the Pedro Pablo Barrientos, we used the Torture Victim Protection Act. In another case that we filed in July, so it's ongoing, we filed the first war crimes lawsuit against the Syrian regime and Bashar al-Assad for war crimes committed by them under the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act. Now, typically, you cannot sue another state because they have sovereign immunity. But in the United States, if they are on a list as a state sponsor of terrorism, you can sue them. And in this case, we represent the family of Marie Colvin, who was a really famous, renowned war correspondent who traveled to hotspots around the globe covering the conflicts in Sri Lanka and Libya and Bosnia. And she described that in her coverage of Syria that it was the worst she had ever seen, and that Bashar al-Assad was simply lying, that he was going after insurgents, that in fact he was decimating the civilian population in Homs, Syria at the time. And we, after a 3.5-year investigation, were able to get the information and the data, satellite imagery and such, to build a case to demonstrate that he's committed war crimes. So we were able to file that lawsuit here in the U.S. It's ongoing. Along with Marie Colvin, who was killed, there was a French reporter who was injured by the last name of Bouvier, and a photographer, Remy Olchek, who was killed. And so the French government, a judge there, has opened a criminal investigation into exactly the same moment when our client was killed. And of course, we've done the investigation. So we have a lot of the data and information that the judge will be looking at and conducting her investigation to determine whether or not criminal charges can be brought and how to proceed in France. Now, in this example, we have one where there's another statute that we're using in the U.S. for a civil action, and it is married now with a criminal inquiry in France.
So let me ask you a little bit more. So when you say we file a case, so in the Syrian example, to whom are you filing the case? What's the legal entity or the jurisdiction that you're filing the case under?
So when I say we, the Center for Justice and Accountability, we represent the client. And the client is Kat Colvin, who is a sister and survivor of Marie Colvin's. So she's the one who has standing to be a plaintiff and filing a civil action against the Assad regime. And we were able to file that case in the district court in the District of Columbia. Assad regime has the opportunity to seek arbitration in The Hague, and we are eagerly awaiting their response.
So in Washington, D.C.?
Yes.
Okay, and then who hears that? Is that a federal judge that hears that?
Or is it a federal judge who will hear
federal
that.
Federal judge, yes. Yeah.
And when did you file that case?
We filed that case in July.
So let's back up then to the remit, really, of this podcast. And my question for you now is, in what way do you rely on academic research to do the work that you do? And I was intrigued by what you said. You had statistical data in Syria, you had satellite imagery, you had a whole host of different, what we would call, you know, broadly speaking, evidence. But I'm curious, where do you draw on the academic outputs? Where do you draw on academic expertise in order to pursue the work that you pursue?
So in the Chilean case that I first mentioned, we had academics who provided expert reports for us who, you know, were able to analyze the data about the support that Allende had prior to the coup, the individuals who were targeted under Pinochet, and in the four decades since, what sort of accountability measures have or mostly have not taken place. So there's academic research of that sort that does look at numbers of prosecutions for accountability to provide some kind of historical narrative. There is, and let me give you two different types of information that are relevant. You know, in a number of cases, we rely on forensic anthropologists to come in. And if the case is about genocide, like there was a Guatemala genocide case against the Mayans, and there was a methodical analysis to determine of the remains, could it be shown that, in fact, you know, Rios Montt had specifically targeted the Mayan population as opposed to just decimating the entire population? And so doing that kind of scientific research and quantitative analysis, you know, plays a critically important role in cases of genocide.
Yes, so a lot of the evidence came out of Guatemala was a mix, wasn't it? It was the forensic work in addition to that statistical work. And I know in one of our earlier podcasts, we spoke to Patrick Ball, who works with Human Rights Data Analysis Group. And a lot of the work he did on that case was just to show that the ratio of killing, if you will, by military officers against indigenous was, that ratio was just simply, you know, 8 times higher for indigenous people in that region than for non-indigenous. And so that's something that you, from a legal perspective and from an advocacy perspective, you're able to use statements like that to help prosecution. Is that right?
Well, not only do we use statements like that, but they're critical. You know, they're a linchpin to being able to prove a case of genocide. And Patrick Ball, you're quite correct, has done just tremendous work in that arena. And let me give you one other example, and this is a very recent one for us. Another venue where we work is before international and hybrid tribunals. We represent 45 Cambodian Americans before the ECCC in Cambodia for the atrocities committed by the Khmer Rouge. And case 002/2 against two of the remaining leading figures of the Khmer Rouge has just concluded. And we submitted an expert report on mass trauma. What we did, we partnered with Stanford University and the medical school there. We gathered data of mass trauma, psychosocial impact on the citizens in Cambodia from the data that has been collected there. And what they did was an analysis to demonstrate the impact of mass trauma, the impact of trauma on mental health. And what we're trying to do with this sort of research and analysis is demonstrate that there is harm and injury that can be provable. Courts have not typically looked at sort of this type of information of mental harm, as part of a case like this. So we're trying to think of sort of new ways to use academic analysis to provide information to a court that the court has not had before.
That's really exciting. So you're really pushing the frontiers here, and you're really using creative ways, not only creative legal means, but also broadening the evidentiary base and drawing on that expertise. You once remarked that you felt sometimes academic research didn't give you the outputs that were useful for the work that you do. So you've made a strong case for how it is useful. I'm curious, what do you think is lacking in academic research, or what is it that academic research could do better to inform the kind of work that you're doing?
I don't know if I have an answer on what it could do better, other than we're on a path right now of trying to tighten the analysis as we gather more data. So, for example, in the podcast you've done on the correlation between human rights and democracy, and to the very first point that I made, that now ultimately our aim is we want to see the rule of law take hold and root in every country so they can prosecute crimes that occur within their borders. And there is the open conversation about the correlation between democracy and rule of law. And there is a lot of data suggesting that when there is democracy, various variables that we all want to see, whether it is on issues of development or in reduction of violence, that they correlate. But I think that's an ongoing analysis and conversation that we will continue to have. So one of the people that we've talked to frequently is Catherine Sicking at Harvard University, and her analysis, especially in Latin America, is that those countries that took rule of law seriously, that rejected efforts at amnesty, have demonstrated a lesser degree of violence since those years, and therefore a greater degree of stability and democracy.
Yes, and her book, Justice Cascade, I think makes that point. And it's absolutely fascinating. Not only was it rule of law, but also countries that had trials. So there was something about that physical moment of having a trial that had a significant impact on the degree to which the country was able to make a more successful transition to democracy, and one that was a deeper consolidation of democracy. And I find that a really compelling argument, and it kind of fits the type of work that you're doing, because you very much want to see that in other countries, not just Latin America, of course.
That's correct. And to those who support our work, they want to know that there is data that proves that the mission that we are pursuing in trying to hold human rights abusers accountable is in fact effective and powerful. And this type of academic research helps us make the case that in fact, our theory of change is one that is critically important.
That's fantastic, because it's really interesting. There's a very strong set of counter-narratives emerging at the moment, right? One comes out of this book about the end times of human rights that Stephen Hopgood has written, in which he criticizes the human rights movement. And he divides the world between a capital H, capital R human rights movement that's sitting in Geneva, New York, etc., that's not really listening to the lowercase H, lowercase R human rights movement that's struggling on the ground. And he's very critical of the movement. So that's one narrative. The other narrative I saw recently is that we somehow have entered a post-human rights world. Human rights are being undermined by strong leaders, populist leaders, the development here in Europe around the Brexit campaign, the developments in the United States around the election of Donald Trump is somehow signaling that human rights no longer matter. And the third narrative, I think, is very powerful, is that human rights work carries with it a certain fatigue, that you have setbacks, you have small successes, you think you're getting forward, you think there's progressive change, and then, of course, you have these setbacks. And I've always argued that human rights people have to be patient, that many times their gains are incremental, that you don't get these massive step change results. And you're still, after all the work you've done in previous organizations before coming to CJA, and now, you're still telling a very positive story, and you're very optimistic about the possibility for positive change, and your theory of change is one that supports that.
Now, two responses, Todd. One, when I worked at Service Members Legal Defense Network on the effort to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, I started, co-founded that organization right at the moment that Don't Ask, Don't Tell became law. So it really wasn't the most promising moment to lead a civil rights effort.
Yeah.
But I had a view that, we could get this done in 20 years. And I think I was sort of naive in thinking that I could change national policy in 20 years' time. But in fact, we did. We did it in 17 years. And to me, that wasn't a long time frame. That in the world of human rights and civil rights, that's a pretty rapid change in attitudes and policies. Yeah, and even now, you know, I look at our work currently on going after human rights abusers. And if you see the rise of sort of autocratic sentiment and you reflect on our U.S. government support of autocrats around the globe in ways that it should not have, and same can be said for other nations, even in the context where we are right now, 2017 in the United States, I look at many opportunities in our work. I think that there is a desire for every country to have the ability to prosecute the crimes within their borders. So there is still a sense of law and order that may not be cloaked in the sort of human rights clothing that we like to use, but there is some room for agreement there. So I still see paths forward, and I also take heart in the fact that no, law takes a long time. Litigation outlasts any individuals typically in the modern context. So we have room to continue to play a long game and advance human rights.
I think that's a wonderful way to wrap things up today. This long game, incremental change, but ultimately quiet victory and an advance forward. It's really reassuring to hear that. I think there's a lot of worry in the world today, and it's very, very nice to hear that you have that hard work, you have that commitment, and the point about 17 years in the U.S. on the Donuts Don't Tell is absolutely stunning, because I was going to ask you how long it took, so you've answered that question neatly. So it just leaves me now just to thank you so much for joining me on this episode of The Rights Track, and thanks once again.
It's good to be with you today. Thanks, Todd.
This episode of The Rights Track was presented by Todd Landman and produced by Chris Garrington of Research Podcasts. Series 2 of the podcast is funded by the Economic and Social Research Council. More information, including all the podcast episodes from Series 1 and accompanying show notes for each of our interviews, is available on our website at www.rightstrack.org.